We have another plan now. Venus, circle with a cross below, which means that the soulish substance, the fluidity of it, is superior to the bone or material fixation of it. That is the matter part. This is the soul. That's Venus. Therefore, she's concerned with feeling. That is passive. Circle with an arrow flying out is Mars, and that means active. We're in the merry month of Mars at the moment, and therefore the forces in the earth are becoming active and tend to throw out their little shoots with red ends on them, waiting to grow. These two are a pair of passive active. It's a method of analysing our universe. And we have another pair, the moon, which means body itself, and the sun. Moon, or luna, and sun, or soul. Now, this means body, and that means force, or that means will, and that means body. We can call it body. And force, or matter and force.
And what is the difference, excuse me, between the passive Venus and the body of the moon?
Well, here we're considering the fact that it doesn't do anything other than receive, and here we're considering that it exists and occupies space. Thus, the moon aspect of that is that it exists and occupies a definite amount of space. The Venus aspect of it is that it won't move unless we push it. The Venus and the Sun differ. The Mars and the Sun differ in this way. Mars is always active. It's always flying out when a certain amount of energy has gone into it. See? But this symbolizes the very concept of force quite independently of whether it has poured itself into something or not. So we now have three pairs and an odd one. And the odd one is the sign of the Messiah. Now, when God is said to create, he creates in 6 days and then rests on the seventh day. Now, the seventh day for the Jews and the seventh day for non-Jews is not the same day. The Christians use the Lord's Day, Sunday, because it means illuminated, enlightened. The Jews use Saturn's Day, because it means material, cover. Now, essentially, the Yiddish type has his book which says, "Obey that thy days may be long in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee." In other words, it's fundamentally materialistic. So Saturn is their favourite day. And Christians are supposed to be wanting to become enlightened, so Sunday is their favourite day. But the favourite day for other folk who know one or two tricks is Mercury's day, Mercury or Wednesday, the quick fellow's day. And the quick fellow doesn't have a materialistic outlook and is not particularly wanting enlightenment as such. He's quite satisfied with the material situation as it is, and that some people want enlightenment, because he's going to balance all of these processes. He doesn't want to be passive, he doesn't want to be active. He wants to be both when he wants to be them. He doesn't want to be conditioned, inertic, passive. He doesn't want to live by liking things passively. He doesn't want to push things about. He doesn't particularly want to be a material body. Hello, Dan. He doesn't particularly want to be a force. He wants to balance all the possibilities. To make the days of the week and look them. We've not got them in the order that they occurred in English here. That is Sunday, Monday, Mars is Tuesday, Tiwus is the old Norse god of war, Venus is Friday, the old Frigga's day, fruit day or pay day. Mercury is Wednesday. Jupiter is Thor's day or Thursday, the hammer's day. And Saturn is Saturday. And if you look at the logic of it, you can see that's why it is that people go making merry on Saturn's day. The Saturnalia, or whoopee time of the ancients. You start your day in a moony state in the working week after you've had a rest in your illuminated state on Sunday. Sunday is supposed to be devoted to illuminating yourself, remembering the Lord on that day. On Monday, you're supposed to start counting again, go back to business. The moon is the counter. Having counted, you're supposed to make war on all your rivals in the business world on Mars Day. On Mercury's Day, you're supposed to be well into the business field because Mercury is the patron saint of businessmen, rogues, thieves, vagabonds, and leg pullers. And on Thursday, it's getting late in the week, so you have to hammer it to get your quota. On Friday, you get paid. That's fruit day. Saturn's day, you make whoopee. And that is the order in which your weekly round is generally conducted. And the funny thing is, it's conducted practically over the Western Hemisphere in the same way, and with very little modification in other countries. In other words, there's an inherent logic about it. Sometime in your life you should sit down and evaluate your position. That's your Sunday. Having found out where you're up to, you should then start the next day counting to see whether you've got the wherewithal. On the next day, you launch forth and you aggress against the world to further your purpose. On the middle day, the Mittwoch of the Germans, you should be really spinning it, rotating the mercurial speed, really getting about like a traveller with 14 different zones up and down the country. See? Thursday, it's getting a little late. Your quota has not been... to apply them all, you will have a very good evaluation of the situation, won't you?
What happens to the loss of time when we get the leap year every 4 years? Does that also particular influence of working?
It doesn't affect this because the amount of error that occurs through using a year that isn't quite right is infinitesimal as far as an individual man is concerned. It is periodically corrected. You remember on one occasion 11 days disappeared from the calendar, and the poor people who didn't know that those 11 days hadn't really been stolen from time and just onto the calendar took a lot of bricks and started throwing them on Whitehall and everywhere they could, demanding back their stolen days. They actually thought they'd had days stolen. Now, all of this, which might look complicated, isn't if you see the underlying logic of it. There must necessarily be to create a contraction. And what existed before the contraction is a state which, after contraction, you could call expansion. Couldn't you? Before you contract, you don't call that the expanded state. You might call it extended if you want. But expansion and contraction are logically opposite ideas which presuppose each other. Before contraction, there is that which is expanded. The expanded is prior and is therefore called Jupiter, God the Father. It then contracts onto a point, and that's the devil or Saturn. And this contraction or self-will is the same thing as ideation, individual value. And you have to balance the expansion of the absolute and the individuatedness of Saturn. That is, you have to be yourself and remember there are other beings as well. See the logic and then restore the whole thing to this diagram and it becomes simple. You've got contraction, expansion and rotation. That's quite simple, aren't they? Then passive and active. That's passive pleasure, active desire. The Venus type is a blonde lady with not much energy, whose fingers press right back until you can touch your wrist with them, and she lives for pleasure. If you found one in your type, be surprised. The Mars type of man has red hair, red skin, and a tremendously zealous nature, and he never waits, he goes bang for the target. You can find a lot of pure types of those, actually, more than the others. The moon aspect simply means the body as a material structure and the sun as a force acting upon it. So that's quite simple, really, isn't it? Convection, expansion produce rotation. That rotation, considered internally, may be viewed as passive, and considered as squirting energy out, is active. Considered as occupying space, we call it a body. Considered as its original force, Jupiter, we call it a force, the sun. So really, those are not very complicated, are they? And we can reduce the 12 signs of the zodiac down to 4 systems in your body, your physical matter represented by the bone, the fluids in your body, your blood, etc., the air in your body, and the nervous energy in your body. Just 4 systems. In 3 phases, the undifferentiated before it gets in your body, the differentiated and unified when it gets in the body, and then the alternation between the two, the mutableness of the third state. So that the top state is like an absolute positive, then the contraction of it, which makes unity, is a negative, and the third state alternates, it's neutral, it goes absolute, particular. You find if you try to think, you have to think about a thing. If you try to think about a thing, you'll have to leave it. Suddenly I decide to think about that pencil. Thinking about it is saying what there is in it. I say, what is it? Well, it's graphite in the middle. What's graphite? Immediately I have to leave the pencil to think about it. That's why we say about. Ab, out, away from it. It's graphite in because it's fairly easy to break. They put it in a piece of wood. What's wood? Trees. It's a piece of... I think that's a piece of Czechoslovakian pine, isn't it? Now, every time we try to think about a thing, we have to leave it and think about something else. And if we see the logic of that, we will never try to think about a thing without thinking about everything else. Because if we think, well, what is wood? It's trees. What are trees? They're kinds of beings that somehow are created by the action of the sun on air, water, and earth. Aren't they? Somehow, a force enters into the air and drags up various chemicals and combines them with water and air, and that's a tree. So already it becomes a cosmic proposition to examine the pencil. And whatever it is, we should always force ourselves back to the universal origin in order to understand what it is. If we think inside our body, what is that? Absolute cause of all things, force. What is it in the body? It is willpower. So there's a definite relation between the willpower of a man and the Jupiter, or cosmic creative force in the universe. But you cannot get at it as long as the rota, the inertia, the habit of you, is using up all your energy. If you're in the groove, if you're a dead man, you can't get the energy out of the groove to use it for another purpose. So there's a very simple test of whether you have got willpower or not. Simply take something you habitually do and don't. Take something that you always do and don't do it for a week. If you manage it, you can say, yes, I have willpower. If you forget about it, you can say, I haven't got willpower yet. But know that if you get it, you have got the same essence with Jupiter, that is, with God the Father. That is, with the cosmic original spirit.
Could you equate the sixfoldness with the twelvefoldness? You spoke about it at the beginning. You drew the first six, which was spoken about with the five sense organs. The 12 arises?
First, we'll take this out, the Mercury, because it's the balance of all those.
Mm-hmm.
And then We consider the contractive side is the part that produces matter, isn't it?
Yeah.
So this Saturn is related specifically to the bones. So why this thing, the skull, which is bony, we say it's a Saturnine compaction. All the bone parts are Saturnine. All the airy parts are Jupiter, the expansion. So your lungs expand, don't they? Mm. The expansion tensor which sucks in the air is your Jupiter function. This Venus is fluid and so is the Moon. But this is the passive aspect of it. And this one is the spatial occupancy of it. So both those two belong to the fluids in the body, and Mars and the Sun belong to the nervous energy in the body. See?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not really a complicated thing when you see the internal relations of them. Mm-hmm. They've been spread out in this way to enable you to analyze the situation. You see a man with a certain kind of body and his head may belong to a slightly different category. You find a man with the coloration of a Latin and the features of a Slav. Well, you can say straight away, his ancestry is mixed. We find some high yellow neguses that look exactly like Jews. Because once upon a time there was a medial type, the Shen type, from which there appeared a Yafetic or intellectual and a Hamitic or sensual. If we bring back the terms together again, we find that we're getting the middle that we started with. So you find a tremendously Jewish look about the high yellow neguses in America.
Mm.
In fact, you could easily mistake them for Jews. Because they are really the products of breeding back into the middle line from which they emerged. The thing is to see the fundamental simple line, and then all this stuff isn't complicated at all. There would be no bodies in the world if there weren't contraction. So Saturn is the very principle of materiality. And then immediately you see why it says in the Bible, the whole world is in the grip of the devil. That is, all matter, whatever, is a product of covetousness, grab. God the Father is expansion and is therefore always at war with Saturn. But Jesus Christ, the Messiah, is called the Mediator. And he tempers the severity of God, who wants to break up the devil's works, by explaining why it is necessary. So Christ mediates between God and the devil. The sinning man is apologized for, because it is the sinning man that keeps him separate. Sin means separation. If all men lost all separation, which would be the same as all sinfulness, the whole universe would suddenly splurge and there would be nothing left. And there's no value in that absolute splurge. Therefore, a certain amount of devilishness is necessary. Sometimes you find little boys running about and their mothers will say, they're proper little devils, those boys. And it means that they're initiating something and separating something and fiddling about and interfering. It isn't necessarily a bad thing. Actually, the only good is the whole, the mercurial resolution of all these oppositions.
Now, can we equate that with that sixfold division we had a few weeks ago, where we saw the universe first as a whole, mm-hmm. then we divided it, didn't we, into what we termed spirituality and materiality, and saw it as a dualism and a plurality?
Yeah.
Could you put that on for everybody?
No, I wouldn't do that, because that is a totally different frame of reference.
Yes, well, that's very wonderful.
It's a totally different frame of reference.
There is an equation, but it would only mix things up at the moment.
It would at the moment.
Yes.
The best thing to do is to familiarise yourself with the internal logic of this thing, and to see that in this sign, Mercury, we have a diagram of a man where he has pinned his sexual energies. He has his whole feeling, and he remembers his dual origin. Those horns up there symbolise that he's rooted in duality, the devil and God the Father. William Blake says the people on earth worship the devil under the name of Jehovah, and they don't know it. Why? Because Jehovah, God, is a creator, but a creator is a finiter, and we don't want finiting, we want freedom. We And why do we want freedom? Because we haven't got it. If we had it, we'd want to be finite. The essential thing is to see that the Saturn-Jupiter opposition is no more than the split of a prime whole, or each split, the triumph of each over all and of all over each. When all triumphs over each is Jupiter. When an each triumphs over all, it is Saturn. So we say that Hitler was the devil because he triumphed over the devil people. He subjugated them to his will. Now, if they'd have subjugated him, we might have called it the tyranny of a bureaucracy or something like that. And it's very, very difficult to equate the many with a particular devil, because the mass itself seems to be its own justification and its own law. The herd makes the rules for the herd, and it always defines an individual who doesn't conform with herd law as a devil. Thus the Pharisees said of Christ, he hath a devil, because he's fiddling about with the Pharisaic law. We must put him on the cross where he belongs, the sign of the devil, nail him up. So that really when he's pinned on the cross, like Moses pinned the serpent up on a cross in the desert, it simply means the cross fixation. If that malcontent or dissatisfied fellow who doesn't like our rules, can be caught by us, we'll nail him onto the thing that he signifies, namely irritant form within the body politic. The Sanskrit word, the only word in Sanskrit for will, is itcha. Itch, the English word itch, irritant. You see, you get the welfare state, and some people think it's an ill-fare state, and start dodging. Now, the government will always define the dodgers as naughty men, but the dodgers will always define the government as a wicked, tyrannical bureaucracy. And the question is, who wins? The winner does the defining. And it's very, very important to realise that what we're dealing with is a whole, and continuously resynthesise this. You see, there is a man who has his awareness consciously that he's rooted in Saturn and Jupiter, in grab and let go. It's as simple as that. Grab, let go. Supposing a man grabs, he gets his penny. Sometimes a little boy's got a penny, it's in his hand. He says, what have you got in hand? He says, a penny. Where are you going with it? Nowhere. Why? It's my penny. What penny is it to spend? He looks very suspiciously at you. You take him to a shop and you say, give this boy something for a penny. And he looks at his penny like that and he won't let go of it. And you say, but it's currency. It's supposed to run about. You've got to let go, otherwise it's useless. Now the boy has to learn that he can't get the value of the penny without opening his hand and letting somebody take the penny and give him something for it. It's this thing, grab and let go. And the important thing is, what are you going to grab and what are you going to let go? If you grab the wrong thing, you'll find you've let go of the other thing. And it's the ability consciously to grab the right thing at the right time and let go of the right thing to let go of, which you would call the wrong thing to hold, also at the right time. And then you've resolved this difference. And we call this the unfallen man, whose horns are at the top. He's aware of the fundamental duality in man, that grab and let go is his origin. And he has in his feeling compassion for all beings, and he knows that all beings are crucified on their physical bodies. So he thinks in terms of a dialectical process, the identity of opposites. He feels compassion for the whole thing, and he knows that he's pinned on a physical body and so is every other body. That's called the unfallen man. Now we'll draw him in his fallen state. Now, he's pinned in his brain on ideas. He's now an intellectualist. He thinks that he can solve the universe in terms of thinking, and logical thinking cannot solve it, because logical thinking says that contraction and expansion are opposites, mutually exclusive, and nothing to do with each other. logically, putting in and taking out are opposite, aren't they? Paralogically, beyond logically, dialectically, both processes are going on simultaneously in the universe. Energy is pouring in and energy is going out. In the same moment, the Atlantic cable that takes a message to America, down its core, is returning a current on the outer sides of the cover, isn't it? There must be circulation. Something is going down there, something is coming back at the same time. Now, we call that paralogical thinking. And the man that thinks only logically, we call him an intellectualist. Remember, IST means he's crucified. He thinks wholly, but now he's walking on two legs. You see? Let us say he's alternating as he goes along. One of his legs is a thinking leg and the other leg is a feeling leg. And he never knows, by thinking, which leg to put down first. We talk about getting up in the morning and putting your right leg down first. And some people are not quite sure whether you should put the left leg down first. Now, in India, where they systematized all this, they said, when you get up in the morning, put down on the floor one of your legs. If you're a Brahmin, put down your left leg in public. If you're in secret, put the right leg down. The right leg means will, going willfully. The left leg means going with circumspection, or looking round about to see what's cooking. So when you're going through life, you have to look all the time. But if you've only got a thinker, a logical thinker, you do not know whether it is time to be willful or just think. When you're dealing with a person, you can't think whether to be willful or not at the moment with him, can you? Just impossible. You're almost invariably out of phase with him. You might try willfulness and he may hit back. You might try thinking, but he's sucking a lollipop at the time. He's not in his intellectual centre. So he can't respond. So this is the fallen man who is an intellectualist. That's like a diagram on the scientist. The legs of him are embedded, if you like, in the material world. And he doesn't know quite what to do about that, because he's a thinking man. And therefore he has to formulate a mathematical analysis of the world based on statistical survey. And he can never deal with an individual. He can only deal with large numbers of things simultaneously. But the unfallen man is aware that he's rooted in grab and let go, aware that the physical bodies of all beings are pinned, and his feeling is of compassion. Now this fellow's feeling here is a whole feeling split by this. His thought process goes down there, and this is like the two lungs. Part of it says it's time to think, part of it says it's time to be willful. But he can never have enough data by thinking. But on the other hand, if you remember this, you can deal with the situation much better. If somebody is absolutely adamant about something, you know in principle that he's very, very soft about precisely that thing, otherwise he wouldn't hammer it so hard. If a man who's absolutely secure about a thing, he doesn't need to hammer it. So, this fellow, the mercurial man, if he comes up against a very dogmatic person, he knows mush is hiding under him. On the other hand, if he comes up against a man apparently mushy, he knows that if he pushes that man and takes his mush off him, he'll suddenly contract into a stone and grab and fight. So you find that apparently tolerant people, when you start trying to find out the limit of their tolerance, they're quite clear that it's so far and no farther. In a recent description, a historical one, he said in about the early 17th century, a group of intolerants, fleeing from intolerance, went to America to establish some more intolerance. Now, we know what we're talking about, the Virginians, the early settlers there. They could not stand the situation in England because the government was squeezing them. But the government was squeezing them because they wanted to squeeze other people, and they wanted such people in America. to form the basis of a government. So they had to squeeze the people that wanted to squeeze, so that they'd fly away, like orange pips between the flies, and then rush off into another country and start doing the same thing on whatever beings were there. And they always do it in the name of the thing they are guilty of. So in the dialectical thinking, the paralogical thinking, whatever a person is, remind yourself that he's also the opposite at the same moment. And state it to yourself. When you become fairly sensitive, you can state it to him too. And he knows it. He might suddenly start grinning and say, well, and let go of it. In this method, you can't do it. If you try to think, you'll be statistical. And you don't know enough about that man with that colour, that height, to be able to predict his reaction. But you do know that all men are everything simultaneously. Therefore, whatever he says he is, maybe he is, but he's also a lot of other things as well. Quite opposite to the things he just said. The more you can see that everything springs out of grab and let go, because it's grab and let go together produces rotation which establishes beings. It's that establishment that gives this passive aspect and the body aspect. And it's the fact that the inpouring of the energy into it makes it squirt out like Mars and gives a force manifestation. So the more you can think about that, the more you will find that it's only an extension of that diagram of the cross in the circle, which is tremendously easy to handle once you've analysed it and then resynthesised it together. See if you can equate these with the different signs in the zodiac. And later on, if you like, for instance, if you look in Genesis 49, you'll find the blessings of Jacob to his sons, and you will there find the characteristics of each of the 12 groups, the kind of people they are, and what kind of things happen to them. To remind yourself, put your mnemonics down on bits of postcard or something, pin them about the place where you know what they are, you know what they represent. If you put them down symbolically like this, you know what they are, nobody else does.
Good thing like decorating your room in a particular
room. Oh, yes. A lot of my friends have got a special room when the wall was done with symbols. So whichever way they look, they get a stimulus to do work. I did a very big one of the geometric relation of all the people I knew on one wall, quite a large wall, a quite plain wall. It's about as high as that and possibly a bit longer. And everybody who came in and looked at this thing was made ill. All it was a geometrical relationship of all the people I knew. And they were all furious about it. But the funny thing was that each person said, I like this one, but I don't like those. And they always picked out the one that represented themselves for liking. And they could feel these discordances. And the whole thing was built up with the compasses from the relations between those people. And done in appropriate colours, you see. So they had their natural colour sympathies there. But they didn't like it. None of them liked it. They only liked a little bit of it. It was just like real human beings.
Did this become a big circular pattern on the wall?
Well, it was made entirely of circles, but they weren't concentric.
No, but like cells around
that's
the
right.
Central one.
That's
you
right.
Would be the central one.
No, I didn't put myself in it.
Well, this was to represent the relationship between you and these other people.
No, it was to represent the relationship that those people had with each other.
Oh, I see. Well, it would be hard to find the central.
Well, everybody thought they knew what was central to them. And they all disagreed about what was central. They all disagreed about their favourite colours. They all disagreed about which circle should go with which circle, which should touch each other, which should intersect at what angle. That's one of those topographical psychological dialogues.
Mm.
Only done completely with the compasses, nothing freehand at all.
It must have given the result something like some of the modern art examples.
Well, some people who didn't know what it was thought it was modern art. They thought it was a mural painting in a modern manner.
You know, earlier you said that in the case of the person who becomes very elated and then very depressed, they shouldn't allow themselves to become too elated, hold themselves down.
Yeah.
Well, if they succeed and hold themselves down on the mean line, doesn't life become drab then? There are no lights and shades.
No, quite the opposite. That's what they're always afraid of. It's because they're afraid of that median line that they allow themselves to become elated. You see, they've got the wrong conception of that median line. That median line is tremendously vital. It's vibrating like this. It's not static. It tries to bounce up, you pull it down. And the funny thing is, every time you pull it down, you are pleased with your ability to do it. Because, you know, fundamentally, the only thing that pleases a man is the ability to do what he wills. Nothing else. So Nietzsche could say the only cause of sorrow in a man is the realization of personal impotence. And the only cause of joy in a man is the realization that he can will. Nietzsche said that for a man, joy is I will. For a woman, joy is he will. That's the statement about active passing, isn't it?
Mm. So that the blacks and whites are not lost.
No.
They'd be seen better.
Mm. Well, a certain Negro who's campaigning to remove the colour bar said if you play a tune on the white notes with no black notes, or a tune on the black notes with no white notes, it's not as good as a tune played on both. Gentleman called Agri.
Mm-hmm.
Or Gray. In fact, they print it in all their Negro propaganda.
Do you remember once saying a pomegranate was, did you say the fruit of the Garden of Eden?
Well, you know that the name of the fruit is not given.
Mm.
When some people say it's an apple, some other people say it's a tomato.
Mm.
You see, the whole thing about the tomatoes is like a pomegranate in Europe, isn't it?
Mm.
The strawberries use inherently for the same idea. Well, the strawberries got the seeds on the outside. It simply means this idea of plurality. If you take a cup sure enough, then. If you take a cup through an apple, you get this shape, don't you?
Mm.
You're seeing from here. You get this threat from duality, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
In the section of it. In the case of the strawberry, the seeds on the outside, the tomato on the inside,
mm-hmm.
and the pomegranate is the oriental equivalent. The pomegranate is used in the Orient, and the fig is used for the same reason, because it's full of seeds.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is plurality in unity. Adam means don't separate. And when he was created Adam, it means whole. But it was found that when he was whole, he was like a circle. He was no good to himself. So it says, God said, it is not good for man to be alone, all one. So he decided to take out from him the volitional aspect and leave him with the intellectual aspect. Namely, he took out a part, called it the woman,
make it dark. This is full of secrets. And then the serpent comes along, that's a stimulus. Stimulates the will. The will runs along and takes the intellect with it. Therefore it says he went first to the woman. Hitler did the same thing in Germany. He talked to women first, knowing he once got the women on his side, he'd go home to Abbey and say, "And Hitler's a fine fellow, get thee into the party."
Well, the words used in the Bible there, as you've just quoted them now, might suggest that God made a mistake when he made man all one, and then he made a correction when he made woman.
Now, this is what the emergent evolutionists say. But a mistake means to take one thing for another that you didn't intend, doesn't it?
Yes.
And it couldn't be that, because when Adam was made, he was the first. Wasn't another to take a miss for him.
No, I meant, well, in error then.
Error means running away.
I have to find another word.
You have to find another idea, because, you see, first of all, we have undifferentiated energy, no creation whatever. Then we create. That's the zone of creation. Now, that's good. God saw everything that he had made on the first day, and it was good. That didn't stop him working on the second day, did it? There is good, better, and best, isn't there?
Yes.
Now, this is good. That's good. You see, better is Beth Torah. Put a law in it. Beth Torah means house of the law. So we set this rotation band going inside. Let's capture into the 12 zones that we mentioned before. That's called better. But best means pure being established. We put the cross in it. BST. Best, spirit, fixed. So that's three stages. Good, that's just making the substance. Better, putting a law in it. Best, pinning it formally. That's the state. Now, on each occasion, he says, and God saw it was good. And when this, he works so far, because the will only works as far as it wants to, and it doesn't work any farther. So at first it worked like that. It had made itself a ball. I thought, that's a fine ball. He thought, that was a good one. I think I'll start cutting it up now, like this. That's good division. Well, I think I'll get it all nicely turning, like this. Get the whole thing fixed. It's good, each stage of it. So if a man is doing a painting, first he gets a decent piece of paper, because that's good paper. Right there. Then he does some primary geometrical structures for the composition. That's good fundamental composition. Then he puts particular forms within it. Those are good. When those are all drawn, then he puts colour on top of it. They're all good in their own levels. So he doesn't make a mistake. He's not in error. First he makes a whole being, and then the whole being, which is free spirit, might undertake to create from itself. But he didn't. He wasn't under constraint, but he went to sleep like a spinning top. So he said, "All right, it's a good piece of spinning top like that. We'll have a bit of something else as well." So he gave it another prong. He took a bit out. And that's established a polar relationship.
Does this mean that when God started to make the universe, that he foresaw what the result would be, or he didn't know? He was doing it to see what the result would be.
No, he knows. Like this. You see, first of all motions, supposing I say this white paper represents spirit, but you can't see the way it's bearing. It's not static, it's highly dynamic. And therefore, it's full of motions wiggling about like this. We call it chaos, don't we?
Yes.
But that chaos is full of all conceivable motions, isn't it? If I stress one of them, there's one, you see.
I begin to abstract a form. But that chaos is full of all conceivable motions, isn't it? If I stress one of them, there's one, you see. I begin to abstract a form. If I like to stress another one like this, there's another form of it, like Schnossel Durante, if you put an eye in it, I think, and a hair on. This is only a question of stressing what already exists. For which reason it is said that God foresaw the world before it was made. And then when he spins like this, he makes inside there, and in this rotating activity, again the overlapping and intersection of forces inside here makes the possibility of special stresses like this, doesn't it? The moment you stress what is, there appears an emergent, an individual, but nothing new. There is no new thing under the sun, but there are new ways of stressing things. So the God, the Absolute Spirit, foresaw in himself everything that could possibly be created, and then he stressed some of it, and that was creation. And he stresses internally, continuously, new stresses, and the appearance of new stresses we call evolution. But nothing can be stressed that doesn't exist. This means that for every individual man, there is an eternal form. Actually, a man exists as a baby forever, and as a child, as a youth, as a man, as grown old, as dying. Forever, in all his phases. When he has stressed them all alternately, then he understands himself. Then he holds the whole concept of himself as born, dead, and in between. And that is his being. Christ, as every man, goes into his own place, and his works follow him. Because death is only the removal of a certain kind of stress, and the putting on of another kind of stress. Which is why Paul says, really, there is no death. In the sense in which people imagine. There's no annihilation of whatever is. Whatever is can never cease to be. Whatever is not can never come to be. But all you can do is stress it, which merely means activate the will in that place a little more. A poltergeist phenomenon exists. No scientist today would deny it. A vase picks itself up and is flung against the wall. Why? It's only power stressed in a certain way. Maybe there's a little girl there and she's not allowed to throw vases about and she wishes she could. And she goes into a sort of stupor with herself and gathers her enemies together, takes it over to the vase because fundamentally it's identical with it, and putting her frequency by sympathy of feeling at the same number as the vase, she suddenly displaces it. She's altered the stress. Those things can happen only because the universe is fundamentally force. Energy. There isn't anything that isn't made of force. When force rotates its matter, when it translates without rotating, we call it a force, a cause. So there aren't any mistakes for God. We can make mistakes. That's like putting your hand in this pocket for a pen and bringing out one. That's an engineering pen. I unscrew it and start writing, and suddenly ink runs all over the paper. Why? Because it won't write unless it's full. If it gets half full, it starts spilling. It's a fault of the pen design. The manufacturers know about it, and they can't cure it, and they warn you about it. Keep it full. If you allow it to get half full, it starts leaking. That's because it's got a special kind of feed. It's the only pen that will take in the ink. But if I forgot and thought I had filled it when I hadn't, and decided to write on my knee, I'd make a mess. That's a mistake. You take one thing amiss for another.
Well, when I used the word mistake, what I meant was, didn't God foresee when he was making man that it would be necessary for there to be woman as well? Did he wait until afterwards and then see that it was necessary?
Woman was in man, in Adam, before she was taken out. Adam was made in the image of God, male and female. That is a hermaphroditic structure. He could have operated on himself if he had willed. He was a free being. But he didn't will to. This is why it is said in tradition that he had a wife before Eve, whose name was Lilith. And because he had Lilith, he refused to work. You know what Lilith means?
No. Lilith.
Was his wife before Eve was taken out of him. Lilith was Eve inside him, and it meant to say that he was getting sensual pleasures inside himself by playing with his own will and intellect instead of expressing. Lilith means to play with oneself. Now there's a lot of people today that are Lilith ridden in that sense. In magical parlance, we'd say they've got a succubus. That is, somehow they manage to use that energy, but they never do anything. Actually, they're doing it inside. They've got this peculiar faculty of sensually pleasing themselves and titillating their imagination with their own will. And it's called Lilith. Very naughty girl, Lilith. Really. And when God saw what Adam was doing, he said, oh, I'll take Lilith out. Change her name from to play to develop. Chava or Eva, Eve, means to develop. You see, so when she's called woman, he said, and she was called woman because she was taken out of man. You know, this war man means out man. Pinch off him, his sensual, volitional side, and leave his intellect where it is. And then the will get into trouble when the stimulus comes and drag the intellect with it, and it'll have to do something. Well, there's many a person gets trapped by internal sensuality like that. You can pick them out very, very easily. They've got dreamy eyes and a certain amount of introversion, and they never make anything on the outside, and a lot of people think they're very quiet. But they've got a universe inside, and all of it fun and games. And they're Lilith ridden.
What can I do with Leith, that Lilith? We'll take a couple of Leith.
Sleep. Pleasant dreaminess. It's a piscatorial tendency.
Yeah.
But it stops work, you know. Stops development. Because you can actually construct inside yourself a wonderful, fantastic and delightful universe without ever getting related to any reality outside yourself.
So it's almost like the taking of drugs, isn't it?
Actually, the people that take opium are going into contact with Lilith by an artificial method.
Mm.
You see, they can't concentrate sufficiently like some people born in certain positions can be naturally. Some fellows can sit down and have an opium dream without the slightest effort. Without opium. You see, now the name of opium in Latin is papaveda. And it means the father as a sexual symbol and the mother playing about in the imagination. And it's that internal process. Actually, that naughty old boy, Alistair Crowley, recommended it as a pastime for certain of his female followers. When they were not physically very attractive, he taught them this method. If they're physically attractive, he taught them another method. But for those who wanted to learn, he taught them this method. That is, how to imagine themselves as man-woman, internally, and have a relationship with themselves. The result was that they lost all external initiative, and thereupon he took their checkbooks, put them in their hands, put a pen in, and said, write, pay Alistair Crowley. And they wrote, and he went away, came back and gave them another lesson. And they thought it was worth it. Some of the old ladies that I know who were members of the organisation, you know, the Dawn thing, and the Women of the Trees, both of which he initiated in London, although there was a rival claimant in Germany for certain aspects.
of the Golden Dawn, some of those women at 60 and 70 who were still interested in sexual activity to the point that they would be prepared to learn the technique and pay for it. And it was just encouraging fantasy. And they were becoming more and more and more passive, more and more subject to his will, because he taught them how to do it.
Easy ways to make money.
Well, it's easy, but the question is, do you like the kind of job that it is?
No.
One of the easiest things in the world, all you've got to do is just hire yourself to May the Veil, put a sign on the door, Lilith, sporting talk. You get immediate buyers.
To overcome that, then you need actually the correct stimulus, don't you?
Yes. External stimulus and application on concrete things. Take any concrete thing like that and universalize it. Try and find out its source. No matter what it is, use the external. Because if you don't, you're locked up in yourself in a fantastic world. And the end of it is that you become depleted of energy. Best method is to take concrete material things like that and deliberately trace their source in the material world, right through from the particular end to their earth origins, their cosmic origins, back to force, and then start on another one. The Buddhists use simply a piece of clay. If they find anybody with a certain type of expression in the eye, they put a piece of clay in his hand and say, meditate on that, it is clay. And he has to think about it. What am I supposed to do about clay? Or what is clay? Earth. What is earth? Well, earth, according to the astronomical theories, was once upon a time liquid, not solid. Before that it was a gas. Before that it was incandescent. A body of light. So somehow that dark clay is only light made dark. How has it become made dark? By compaction. Too much grab. Too little grab, you've got an ocean of light with nothing in it. Too much grab, you've got darkness. Somewhere between, in that vibration, the mercurial resolution, you have light dark, chiaroscuro, the great relation, the possibility of real value. You get a picture on white paper and paint it in white paint. It's a good picture, but you can't see it. That's what God used to do before creation. He painted in light on light. And the devil said, well, I'll paint in black on black, just to be awkward. So Mercury said, well, I'll paint in black on white and white on black, and resolve it. So the Mercury man is the fellow that knows the rooting of everything in this opposition and utilizes it.
Means the Mercury man can change his viewpoint from one side to the other. That's what it really means, isn't it? Changing his viewpoint.
Oh, yes. You see, there's a very old Chinese saying which says, if you knew the truth, the real truth, and you knew it only in one way, it wouldn't help you except in one condition, in one time and place. So you've got to know the truth from every conceivable angle. You've got to get elasticity, otherwise you're useless. Many a technical expert cannot resolve the most elementary problem because he lacks the external stimulus of apparatus that he's used to. If you give him a piece of cotton and sealing wax, if he were able to get down off his high horse, he could arrange that thing in such a way to get a similar effect. But he doesn't remember, because he's too technically trained. In one direction. Come off that horse and get another horse. Get all the horses that are and ride them all.
To do that, universalize it. Who said that if you did it properly once, that would be sufficient? But if we do it unclean times, because we've not been doing it properly,
still learning how to do it.
It isn't so much that. You can do it once properly, and immediately afterwards you will discover you're back in your ordinary physical consciousness because of the fact of the mass inertia of your previous thought. You've done it quite correctly, but you cannot maintain it unless you transmute the body. See, by special efforts you can get a flash and you can see the whole truth, and then a few seconds afterwards you can't be quite sure that you've seen it, but you know that you've seen it, and somehow it's not as bright as it was. It's simply the fact that the body has got to be reconditioned and made fine enough to receive that light all the time, instead of by special effort.
What happens when it lasts a matter of days? Say this particular time of the year, which is building up to a period, say at Easter, mm-hmm. when there becomes, or just after illumination, which might last for quite a length of time.
Well, there again, the external environment is conspiring to give it to you. It's not your work. See, the environment is giving it to you.
Yes.
That's the tide that takes the flood leads on to fortune. But the point is, can you restate that condition when it's not Easter? Easter is the yest time, the uprising time. It's easy to be optimistic in the spring.
Mm.
Everything is conspiring with you. Can you be optimistic in the winter? You know the Chinese say...
I was going to say, doesn't Shakespeare talk about the winter of discontent?
Yes, now it's the winter of discontent. The point, this is again dialectical thinking. You take your bow and see broiled duck, this Chinese gentleman, don't you? The thing is, you can go too far. Actually, that bow is broiled duck, potentially, if you're a good shot. And there's a duck about. And it's the season of ducks. Otherwise, you're wasting your time with the bow, aren't you? So the point is to get the instrument that you have and look for the right time and work while it is light, like working on the concept of the resurrection at Easter time. See? Work while it is light means work when nature is conspiring with you. Because at first the winter will come and you cannot work so optimistically because it's miserable weather. But after a time you gain the ability to work when it is dark. But that isn't a man, because it says the night comes when no man can work. That intellectual fellow, the upside-down man, can't work, except in the right situation. But the man with the horns, the dialectical horns, can, because he says, if winter comes, can spring be far behind? Because he understands the cycle of events. So when he sees a snow landscape, he sees seeds underneath the snow hiding and warmed, protected by the snow. So he looks underneath the superficial darkness to those potentials hidden. And he knows by the law of psychic activity that because winter is here and no thing can persist, therefore there must be none winter following. So spring must come, the martial force must shoot out. A lot of energies are poured into the earth in summer, aren't they? In autumn, the earth is full of energies, and then they hide in the seeds, don't they? The fruits are falling off the trees, the seeds are in the ground, the snow covers them up, and underneath they're waiting for the stimulus from outside that's going to hit them again when Mars, the ram sign, comes in, the energy comes from the cosmos, the solar forces come, bang into those seeds, the melting snows swell the jackets, the energy goes inside the burst, and the shoot comes out. Sir John Barleycorn cycle, which is another example of the messianic winter crucifixion and resurrection in the spring. The whole thing is a cosmic cycle. The agricultural corn cycle is borrowed from the cosmic cycle. Some anthropologists think it's the other way around. They think that man first made a corn cycle and then thought cosmically about it. The cosmos existed before the corn cycle.
What is the best way to get back into that state, having experienced it a number of times, particularly at periods like Easter, and then to find yourself I suppose, in a state of fall again, of not understanding it.
Well, the best thing is, when you're in it, to watch like mad what kind of feeling you've got, and observe it so cleanly that you can remember the feeling.
Mm.
So that later, when you've gone out of it, you have a memory that you had a feeling of a definite type.
I'd say the effect it had on me when I done it, and that is that I know I can get back into it, but inertia says, well, it'll do tomorrow. I can remember it, well done.
Yes.
And then, if I make a big effort to do it, I find that I've got to make an even greater effort than the one I thought necessary.
Mm.
And it can be done, but it...
can be done.
But at that particular period, it's easier to do it. That's the way I've experienced
it. Remember that there is a force in the universe, that compression force, the centripetal force, pressing onto the centre and trying to persuade you to generate physically. And that is your physical mass inertia. What it wants you to do is have a lot of physical babies. There's another force, but it's of a totally different frequency, calling out those people who are ready to come out. But at this period of macrocosmic history, the forces are still going in. Because the object of the world soul is to generate a plurality of free beings so that they can have relations of a very high order. But you can't have a plurality of free beings without having a large number of bodies to serve as vehicles for training. And those bodies have got to be made, and free beings don't like tying themselves down. Therefore, there is a structure in the universe called Maya, the grand illusion, which makes everything in the spring look slightly different. You see, there's a halo put around things. It's a trick inside the nervous system, you see. Thereupon, people are tricked into generating the physical bodies which will serve as vehicles of experience for souls to become free. Now, there's got to be a very definite number of such bodies made over a cycle of years. Somebody's got to make them. If you see the light by special effort, well then the forces that want you to make physical bodies will try to pull you down again. And they'll say, well, the light's always there, why have it today? And they'll have wonderful explanations about why you shouldn't bother to go back into the light.
Are you missing something?
It's always there. St. Augustine expressed it in his autobiography by saying a prayer, O Lord, deliver me from the concupiscence of the flesh, but not today. Now he writes those words in his autobiography, and he was a great psychologist and self-searcher, and it was a genuine prayer. He was fed up with that generation cycle. You know, there's a three B's of St. Augustine represent his life story. Three B's: born, bothered, and bishop. It's the same with St. Francis. St. Francis became a great saint because, first of all, he'd been a great sinner. If you do enough naughtiness, you begin to become convinced that it's not worth it. And that's the people that never do it are never sure that it's not worth it. And that's the meaning of the prodigal son. And if you say that to some people, you say, oh, but well, I'm going to go and be a prodigal then. If that's so, but they're using your words as an excuse for weakness. They can't do it. And then if the first time they get into trouble, they come, and they say to you, it's your fault, you told me to do so-and-so. I can give you an actual concrete example of one evening in a group like this, I made a general statement about the prodigal son, a quite general statement, that prodigality was not a bad thing in itself. And that for many people it accelerated their development because they could give things up quicker than they would otherwise give it up. But this was always a matter for an individual to solve. You see? And about 6 months later, a fellow came to me and he said, you know that you're responsible for my girlfriend? She's going to have a baby. I said, why? He said, because of that stuff you said about the prodigal son. You see, and he was quite annoyed about it, and he was very sincere. He thought he'd been led out of the spout by encouraging prodigality. And I said to him, most of the prodigals I know I'm very, very careful about that kind of result. But he actually was very, very annoyed with me for mentioning the prodigal.
It accelerated something, certainly. A new being.
Well, it actually accelerated him wonderfully. And his wife. It accelerated him into marriage, a thing he would never have done otherwise.
That's what you would call an object lesson.
Oh, yeah. Very objectionable lesson, David. But it did him good in the end, you know. I mean, the end up to now. That's the way. Finally.
Will you excuse me now?
Yes, of course.
Have a push off.
Well, first of all, you cannot see that unless you manage to stop thinking for a period. See, the thing that stops people from getting at that light, which is eternal and permanently there, we're in it actually, it's another frequency, is fantasy and ideation. That means to say you've got all the formulations in your mind, all formulations of feeling and idea, are the things that block you.
Yes.
So that the precondition of seeing it is, first of all, you must eliminate from the mind ideas. That's why in yoga is the suppression of vrittis, of mental modifications. That's the Patanjali definition. It's still the only valid definition there is. Stop the mind working at the lower levels, and the top levels will be seen because they're there. Now, the obstacle, the chief obstacle to this is falling asleep.
Yes.
Falling asleep. It isn't a question of stopping the mind thinking and falling asleep. You've got to stop the mind thinking and remain awake. The tendency is to fall asleep. In order to practice it, you take a stream of thoughts, no matter what it is, and you deliberately try to stop one thought getting away from you and stop the next associated thought coming in. When you've got a space between the two, try and increase the space. We use the example of a horse and a cart. There's a horse and cart there, and a man comes, unharnesses the horse, and takes the cart away. While the cart has been taken away by the man, the horse runs away, leaving a space. Now you're trying to hold that space. Just hold it, blank. But you're terribly alert, and you'll feel ideas trying to get in. Don't let them. Keep that space. If something comes into that space, start again. Put your horse in your car.
It's the point of coming to a certain extent, dealing with a picture for you. There's a house and stuff. I don't know, it's the words and the talk that's going on inside.
It's all ideation. Talking is also ideation.
And so what has happened, I've actually got to a state where it's actually in my consciousness, really. I've come back, floated back out of it. I found out without talking, now it's only guessing, it seems to have continued and been going on all the time, even though I wasn't there. Now, whether it's actually started again from where?
No, it's going on all the time.
You leave it and you come back and it's still going on.
Everything goes on all the time because everything that exists is eternal. What you're doing is changing your phase. When you can't hear it, you've gone out of its frequency range. That's all, but it's still talking there.
Wow.
Do you know every word you've ever heard in your life is sounding on its own all the time? And every sentence, which is a combination of words, is also sounding, because all the words that constitute your vocabulary are vibrating all the time.
As one?
Yes, as one whole.
Yes. According to the particular opening you make within yourself, that's what you receive, actually, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What you do is you stress a thing, and it's your feeling that determines what you will stress. The thing you like, the thing you dislike. The thing you like, you tend to move towards. The thing you dislike, you tend to be afraid of, and it presents itself. But talking is still ideation, it's still formal presentation.
Yeah. have to take the sentence and actually widen the words at the same time.
It's the kind of exercise that we start with. You say to you do it now, you see. I will say to you a series of numbers, and you mustn't hear the last one that would logically follow. So I say, twice three are...
Look, it's hard to see whether you've done it or not. That really should jump in. I'm not actually...
Did you manage to keep it out?
No, I can't say that. There's a tendency sometimes. I tell you, I find it hard to tell you whether I said it or not. In fact, quite often I find myself stressing it in my throat, you see.
Now, that kind of laryngeal reflex, you see.
But I don't know if it was there in the mind or not.
There's a question of levels, you see. When we talk about prayer, there's three levels of prayer. Audible prayer, where you can hear the words coming out of your mouth. Inaudible prayer, where you can feel the reflex in your larynx. And silent prayer, which is still a form, but there's no reflex here. And there's no sound out of your mouth. But you can hear the form of it in the mind. But there's no physical reflex. It's a different level, it's a different frequency. Then if you take the meaning of that prayer and contract all the words together and retain significance without serial expression, that's the fourth kind.
Oh yes, I know what you mean.
That's taking significance instead of serial expression.
So I say happiness and just feel happiness, you see, instead of with no particular word.
That's right, you identify with the significance of the term. Now, see if you can do this again. We will recite the alphabet. Don't you hear the next letter when I stop? A, B, C, D, E. Did you manage to suppress it?
No, it came off. I can't say that I would, but nothing happened.
You see, you should be able to stop it so that you don't know what comes next. Otherwise, it's still inertia, it's still mechanics.
It was happening without my intention when it came up.
Well, it's quite mechanical, it wasn't your intent. Your intent could be the opposite, but it would still come up unless you're tremendously alert. Don't let the final word come in this. Rule Britannia, Britannia rules the...
I said monkey instead.
You said monkey, that's a device, you see. But did you notice that the monkey that you inserted was a jumping monkey, like the wave motion? What you did is abstract the jumping from the wave and turn it into a monkey to avoid the word wave.
Yes.
That's still mechanical association of ideas. See? Now this is an exercise you can do on yourself and you can do on each other as an exercise, and really try, prepare yourself, because if you get prepared and you get a pal to try you out, you can gain this ability, chop it, and you just don't know the alphabet anymore. The M.O. at Strangeways prison in Manchester has a wife, and I was talking to him one night, we were having supper with him, and he said, my wife's a yoga, you know. And I said, is she really? And he said, yes, she's terribly good at it. She's read all about it. She's very, very good at it. So I said to her, have you done that exercise of emptying your mind? And she said, yes, which one? So I said, the one about the horse and the cart, where you let the horse run away when the man takes the cart away and there's nothing there. She said, what is it? I said, well, she said, you can do it. And he interrupted and said, of course she can do it. She's practiced yoga. I said, well, we'll see if she can. I said, now imagine a horse and cart, and a man comes, he harnesses the horse, takes the cart away, and suddenly the horse runs off. And there's a space there. Can you do that? And she went, oh! He said, there's a man behind the car. You see? It gave her a terrific shock. It would have given him a shock too if he had seen which man. It wasn't him. See? It was another man. a threatening figure. One of the many convicts that she'd noticed that he had to deal with. Because being a convict, he's not necessarily been so wicked that you're positively horrible to look at, you know. Some of them are quite good looking. And the threat of violence is there. So he was behind the cart waiting till hubby had gone away to M.O. things.
He was actually imprisoned within herself.
If you do that exercise with each other, you can go ahead very, very quickly. It's hard to work on your own. Get somebody to say something with a natural, logical sequence, and you try and chop it so that you just don't know. And don't try and put a monkey there. That's still a mechanical association of ideas.
The point is, I haven't got to follow you all the way, each letter.
Yes.
But the point is, I find this. You're saying A, B, C, D. You're going at a certain speed where I can't tell whether I'm actually presupposing or not. But by the time you've done your next letter, you see. When you stop, I'm not even prepared.
Well, you mustn't hear anything before me during the exercise. There must be nothing in your mind except the things that I say, and then when I stop, you must stop thinking.
That would be a good thing to get up and over here.
Oh, yes. The lower and more forward your consciousness, unless you can do it. Because there's an awful lot of associative mechanism down here, fundamental ideas, that works tremendously.
You know in the word association exercise, can you start to get used to it and able to carry on for longer?
Yes, a very good exercise with words is this. Now, every word is built of primary letters, and only primary letters coexist eternally as forms, so that every word in every language is merely an outgrowth, an expression, pressing out, of a fundamental geometry of the universe which exists simultaneously. That means that all words in all languages are related together in a very definite manner. So when you look at a word, see if you can see another word inside it. Take it out and know that if it's in, it's got a logical relationship to that word. Let's take the word word. Inside the word word is the word war, W-O-R, as in worship, you know, worship. It has a very definite relation because you can't worship without words. If you look up this prime root, this W-R root, it means a power differentiating, illuminating its parts. There's also ORD, which is the root of order, and you can't make order without words. There's also OR, which is gold, isn't it?
Gold.
Or is gold. And gold is the same thing as will. Gold is a symbol of willpower. So inside the word, there is a principle of order, a principle of worship, and a principle of will, and the will is hidden in between. The will is hidden in the middle. That means that every word you've got really conceals in it a will. That means it tells you, if you analyse it, there's something you can do. Take a short word like cat. What does it mean? What is a catastrophe? What is a pussycat? The Greek word cat means fixed. The pussycat is so called because it sits in fixed attitudes, and when it moves, it suddenly takes the whole of its concentration from one place and puts it on another. And it fixes its attention. We know that. Yeah. It's called cat, because it fixes itself. Now this fixing is the same thing as cutting off, isn't it? Take the vowel out and see KT sound. It's the fundamental concept, cut. The cat does that. It forgets all about you, and it sees something down there. Some people think the cats are very queer. The Egyptians thought they were sacred. There's a cat that can be looking at you and you give him something else. It stares in midair and people go, That cat has seen something. That's a frequency that human beings don't see. It really has. It's got a totally different gamut of vibrations in its awareness to a human being. You know that when the big earthquakes occurred in South America a few years ago, 2 days before it blew up, the animals migrated. They all left. And the human beings are saying, "What's the matter with all the animals running about with stupid things? What are they being excited about?" The first day, all the animals cleared off, and towards the second day, and all the birds flew. That's funny, isn't it? The birds went after the runners.
I'll be off too,
you see? And they were all saying, "Oh, aren't animals funny?" So there was a big bang. And the whole place was buried in a few hours. Now, who told the animals? The fact is that the forces in the earth that were ready to blow up were beating at very, very high frequencies. And the animals could feel that terrible proximity of an explosion. It was real. They didn't see the future. They saw the present condition of imminence. Terrible vibration in the earth and in the ether when all these intermagnetic forces in the earth were crushing the strata underneath. They could feel this emanating. So they thought, "I think it's time to go." And they went. They just went. That reaction is the same thing as intelligence as far as animals are concerned. Providing they're in their natural habitat, its survival value is perfect. And human beings upside down thinking, as it should be said, can't possibly blow up, you know, because statistically it hasn't blown up before. Statistically, it says times plus times to one that it will never happen again. And it hasn't happened at all yet. The statistics ignores that it was always the first time. There was a magnificent film of the Mexican one. Did you see it? They managed to get on the spot with cameras.
Oh, yes, yes, I did.
And the mountain was thrown up in a few hours. A colossal mountain, 3,000 feet, wasn't it? It just grew like this, and the bridge disappeared, and everybody's rushing off in all directions. And after it had been put up in a few hours, the geologist said, "We shall have to modify some of our time scale about the formation of the Earth's crust." You know, they had some wonderful ideas of how long it takes to raise a mountain range 3,000 feet high. It takes a long time. It's about 4 hours, I think, it threw itself up in its major mass. And they were surprised. So they wrote it down in the book, "Modification of Statistical Survey."